This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With the moderating centrist voice of Sandra Day O'Connor gone from the Supreme Court, a conservative counter-revolution that had been stymied for 20 years has now begun. So says Jeffrey Toobin in his new book, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. His book is about how this counter-revolution developed. It's also a behind-the-scenes look at the court, its recent decisions, and the personalities of the justices behind them. The Nine is based on interviews with justices and their law clerks that were given on a not-for-attribution basis. Toobin is senior legal analyst for CNN and a staff writer for The New Yorker. One chapter of his new book revisits the decision Bush v. Gore, which he wrote about in a best-selling book. In that decision, the Supreme Court stopped the Florida recount in the contested 2000 presidential election and allowed the Florida certification of Bush's victory to stand. This put Bush over the top in electoral votes, making him president. In Toobin's new book, he comes up with some new, revealing stories about that decision. Isn't this the decision that Supreme Court justices are most uncomfortable talking about?
I think they all know that in the second paragraph of their obituaries will be how they voted in Bush v. Gore. That defined them. And what particularly bothered them about the case is that it was so nakedly political. The justices have a conception of themselves that is separate from politics. I mean, they are realistic, they are practical people, but they also try to portray themselves, even to themselves, as apart from politics. And this was so political and so sort of grotesquely partisan that that's what really makes them uncomfortable about it.
Now, you write a lot about Sandra Day O'Connor throughout your book. She figures, of course, prominently in the Bush v. Gore chapter. You say that she had her mind made up about Bush v. Gore. She thought George W. Bush should win the case as well as the election. Why?
Well, Sandra O'Connor is a Republican, and proudly so. She was the majority leader of the Arizona Senate. She identifies with Republicans. She particularly liked the elder President Bush and his wife Barbara. Those were her kind of Republicans. And on election night, she was and her husband were unusually open about their hope for President Bush to win the election. Once the case got into the Supreme Court, the complaints of the Democrats were exactly the kind of thing that O'Connor hated. She thought that the case was about voters who had made mistakes, who were incompetent, who were complaining and making excuses, just the kind of thing that O'Connor, the old ranch hand from Arizona, just didn't like to hear. So the combination of her predilection for the Bush family and the kind of complaints the Democrats were making really turned O'Connor off. And I believe that the Democrats never really had a chance to get her vote in this case.
But you think that she later regretted her decision and that she became disillusioned about the Republican Party and the presidency of George W. Bush.
See, this is what I really learned in writing my book. This is the surprise to me, is the effect the decision had on O'Connor, because the reaction to Bush v. Gore was so extreme and so angry that it really challenged O'Connor's conception of herself as someone who was fair and nonpartisan and someone who was a Supreme Court justice universally respected, and she was really taken aback by that. You combine that reaction with what George Bush's presidency turned out to be, something very different from what O'Connor thought it would be, a very conservative presidency. She did not like John Ashcroft, who was the President Bush's first attorney general. Justice O'Connor is not an evangelical Christian right Republican. She is an old school country club Republican. And as the new President Bush became more and more conservative, especially when it came to civil liberties after 9/11, O'Connor rebelled. in part because she was worried about her historical reputation in light of Bush v. Gore, and in part because she simply did not like the direction the Bush administration was going.
What's a decision in which you think her opinion was a rebellion against President Bush?
Well, I think the Guantanamo Bay cases were a direct repudiation of President Bush. I mean, there's this extraordinary moment in the court where the argument of the first Guantanamo Bay cases takes place in 2003 in the spring. And Justice Ginsburg asks a question, and she says in the oral argument to Paul Clement, who was then the Deputy Solicitor General, you know, what if the president decided to authorize torture? I mean, do you think he could do that? And Paul Clement gets rather indignant and says, well, our president would never do such a thing. That very night, the night of the oral argument in the Guantanamo Bay cases, is the night that 60 Minutes 2 broadcast the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse story for the first time. And that's when the court really rebels against the Bush administration. And it's O'Connor who really lectures the Bush administration in her opinion in that case, where she says, you know, in times of national crises, that's when we have to stand strongest for civil liberties. And she cites the Korematsu case, one of the darkest moments in the history of the Supreme Court, which approved the exclusion of the Japanese from the West Coast during World War II. And she essentially saw the Bush administration as repeating those sorts of mistakes. And that case was an extraordinary public rebuke of the Bush administration, and the court was led by its ever-present swing justice, O'Connor.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, and we're talking about his new book, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. Now, let's get back to Bush v. Gore. You write a little bit about Justice Kennedy's equal protection argument in that case and why Ruth Bader Ginsburg was so outraged by it. Would you describe his equal protection argument and why Ginsburg was so outraged?
Well, what's interesting about, you know, reconstructing Bush v. Gore is that even though the Supreme Court was only involved in 21 of the 36 days of the fight after the election of 2000, a lot happened. There were two different Supreme Court arguments and decisions, and the Bush team basically, almost as a throwaway in the beginning of this, in the beginning of the legal fight, said, "Well, you know, it's a violation of the of Bush's rights under the Equal Protection Clause that the votes will be counted one way in one county and one way in another county." Now, this argument was almost laughable in the beginning because this Supreme Court, the more conservative Rehnquist Court, had been contracting the Equal Protection Clause, had been narrowing the rights that could be asserted, usually by racial minorities. And the idea that George Bush could be a victim of equal protection seemed almost preposterous even to the Bush lawyers themselves. But Anthony Kennedy, in the oral argument of Bush v. Gore, embraced it and wound up writing part of the decision, that part of the decision saying that Bush's rights had been discriminated against. Now, Ruth Bader Ginsburg had devoted her career to the Equal Protection Clause. She had been the leading lawyer for women who had been aggrieved by gender discrimination. She knew the Equal Protection Clause better than any of the other justices on the court. And the idea that George W. Bush would be the beneficiary of this clause that was being narrowed for women, for blacks, made her enraged. But Kennedy had the votes, and that's the decision. What almost made it worse for the dissenters was perhaps the most notorious sentence in Bush v. Gore, because at the last minute, the majority worried about creating all sorts of new rights and new lawsuits in elections. So Kennedy added a sentence in his opinion that said, "Our decision is limited to the present circumstances." In other words, the only beneficiary of this principle was George W. Bush. We're not going to give this right to anyone else. We're just going to give it to Bush, which was a complete repudiation of what courts based on precedents are supposed to do. But, you know, when you got the votes, you got the votes. And that's how the election ended.
Now, you write that David Souter seriously considered resigning after Bush v. Gore. How come?
See, this was the biggest surprise to me in writing The Nine, because Souter is such a peculiar and unique figure on the court because he's so different from the others. I mean, as most people know, he's the only bachelor justice. He's never been married. He lives this very ascetic lifestyle. He eats an apple and a cup of yogurt for lunch every day. When he arrived at the court, he'd never heard of this drink that some of the other justices drink called Diet Coke. he just leads this very ascetic life. But he takes the court very seriously, and you know, he believes that judges should be divorced from politics, and he has really been divorced from politics for a long time. He saw Bush v. Gore as such a repudiation of the role of the judge. He thought the majority was so nakedly political, and frankly, he didn't like living in Washington much anyway and still doesn't, that he seriously considered resigning, and he almost did. Yet one of the even more oddities of his story is one reason why he didn't resign is because of the rule of 80. The rule of 80 says you get to resign with a full pension, with full salary as a federal judge, if the years of your service plus your age equal 80, like 65 years old plus 15 years on the bench. He wasn't eligible for his full retirement until 2004. So he's such a frugal New Englander that, you know what, the hanging around for the pension seemed like the retiring at full salary seemed like a good idea too. So, you know, for such reasons, large decisions are made.
One of the things you certainly couldn't possibly have known in 2002 when you wrote your book on Bush v. Gore and the Florida recount was that one of the lawyers involved with the Republicans for the Florida recount would later become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts. So tell us a little bit, have you learned more about his role in the Florida recount?
I did. And, you know, John Roberts has led a completely charmed life. And, you know, he was known as a Republican lawyer. He was Deputy Solicitor General under Ken Starr in the first Bush administration, but he never really spoke out much publicly. And like a lot of the top lawyers in Republican lawyers in Washington, he pitched in the recount, and he played a very important but behind-the-scenes role. He went down to Tallahassee after the first Florida Supreme Court decision, which Gore's side won. And one of the debates that the Republicans were having is, should we even apply for cert? You know, go ask the Supreme Court to hear this case, because, you know, this was basically a state issue. It was an interpretation of Florida law, the Florida Constitution. Will the justices want this case? And John Roberts, sitting around the conference room in Tallahassee, said to his colleagues, go for cert. The justices will take this case. This is too important for them to say no. And unlike many of his colleagues, Roberts was right. The justices did take the case. Now, the interesting historical question is, well, why didn't Roberts stay with it? Well, Roberts actually had to go back to Washington because he had a Supreme Court argument in a completely separate case. So that was his only contribution, but it was a significant one because not everyone agreed with him, but he was right.
Did you think it was at all inappropriate to appoint a Supreme Court justice who helped give the president his victory?
Not really. You know, I mean, he was a lawyer helping with a client. Ted Olson was obviously the main lawyer, mm-hmm. and he was appointed Solicitor General. You know, George Bush has been very good for rewarding the people who were with him from the beginning, and I don't really think that there's anything inappropriate about that.
Now, as I said before, you write a lot about Sandra Day O'Connor and about her style as the swing vote in the Rehnquist court. How would you describe that style?
O'Connor's style was more political than legal, and her political instincts were unerring for the center of American public opinion. She supported the right to choose abortion, but with restrictions like parental consent laws. She supported affirmative action, but with strict limits on quotas and the degree of affirmative action. She had this unerring sense that was not necessarily dictated by the Constitution, and it drove Antonin Scalia crazy that O'Connor came to these compromise positions sort of outside any larger judicial framework. But one reason why O'Connor was so successful as a justice is that she was able to occupy that center ground and control the outcome of important decision after important decision.
And one decision that she controlled in some ways was the challenge to the Pennsylvania state law limiting a woman's right to abortion, and the law was challenged in the Supreme Court. What did she add to that decision?
Well, this is where, you know, the historical ironies are so great, because there was one part of the Pennsylvania law that really offended her. This was relatively early in her career. This case was from 1992, and Pennsylvania passed a law that restricted abortion in various ways. But the one part that really got under O'Connor's skin was married women who sought abortions had to inform their husbands first before they got an abortion. And if there's one thing O'Connor couldn't stand, it was paternalism towards women. And that part of the law had been supported by one judge on the three-judge panel on the Third Circuit. Now, who was that one judge? Young Samuel Alito, who had just been appointed to the Third Circuit. And O'Connor was horrified by that part of the decision. So when Justice Souter, Justice Kennedy, and Justice O'Connor got together to write their opinion in the Casey decision, which would support a woman's right to choose, O'Connor took the part just tearing apart Alito's argument and saying it was paternalism, it was outrageous, and it was unfair. And that is really one of her most significant moments as a justice, and who, of course, becomes her replacement but Samuel Alito.
What does she have to say about that?
Well, in public, Justice O'Connor is a very politic person. But the story of her last years on the bench is really an extraordinary personal and political tragedy, because O'Connor became so alienated from the Bush administration about the war on terror, about the war in Iraq, about extremism in all sorts of areas, that she really grew to detest President Bush. But she had a personal tragedy. Her husband had Alzheimer's disease, and O'Connor believed that she had to leave the court to take care of her husband. And even though she was 75 years old and in perfect health and at the peak of her powers, she said, "I'm not outsourcing this. I'm going to leave." So it meant giving her seat to the president she had come to disdain. And not only that, who winds up taking her place but Samuel Alito, the judge that she had almost defined her career by repudiating, which was bad enough. But the worst of all is that after the extended time it took for her to leave the bench, because if you recall, first John Roberts was nominated for her seat, then Rehnquist died, then it was the Harriet Myers fiasco, and then it was finally Samuel Alito. During that period, her husband's health deteriorated to such a point that he was really beyond her help. So here she is. She's given up her seat on the court. She's turned it over to a president and a justice that she doesn't like, all to help a husband who is now beyond her help. I mean, it's really a tragic story.
Do you think that if she knew that that would be the outcome, that she would have stayed on the court?
One of the things about Justice O'Connor is she's not big on looking back, and she's not big on regrets. One thing you'll never get O'Connor to say, including about Bush v. Gore, is, "I was wrong." And she's not going to say, "I was wrong to leave the court." And I'd certainly never heard her say it in public or any other place. But in her heart, my guess is she does regret a lot of this.
When you say that Sandra Day O'Connor came to detest the Bush presidency. Is that based on conversations with her?
You know, I haven't talked about what the basis of my reporting is, but you're just going to have to trust me on it.
For a long time, Sandra Day O'Connor was the swing vote on the court, and now it's Justice Kennedy. How do they compare as swing votes?
They're very different. Justice O'Connor was very practical, very narrow in her decisions. Justice Kennedy is a very expansive person, given to flights of rhetoric that O'Connor never would. He also has a very romantic conception of the judge. One of the many peculiarities about Justice Kennedy is that in some respects he appeared like a very provincial man. When he was nominated to the Supreme Court in 1987, he still lived in the house in Sacramento where he grew up. But he had this tremendous wanderlust at the same time. And the touchstone of his career as a justice has been traveling around the world talking to other justices and talking about the Guild of Judges, and he's been very influenced by foreign judges on certain issues, like the death penalty, like gay rights, where he has moved significantly to the left. But on most issues, he remains the Republican Ed Meese protege that he was in California, and he is a more conservative justice than O'Connor was, and the fact that these decisions, so many decisions are now in his hands as opposed to O'Connor's hands, as we saw in the term that ended in June, this is a much more conservative court than it was just 2 years ago.
Well, let's compare Kennedy's role in the latest abortion decision. Sandra Day O'Connor supported the right to have an abortion, although she also supported certain restrictions on it. In the latest abortion decision, Kennedy wrote an opinion that said, "While we find no reliable data to measure the phenomenon, it seems unexceptionable to conclude some women come to regret their choice to abort the infant life they once created and sustained." Would you discuss that line and its importance in the latest abortion decision?
Just a remarkable transformation. In 2000, the Supreme Court examined a late-term partial birth abortion law, whatever term you want to use, from Nebraska. And by a 5-4 vote with O'Connor in the majority, they rejected the law. They said it was a violation of a woman's right to choose. 7 years later, Congress, in almost total defiance of the court, says, we're going to pass virtually the same law. But because Alito and Roberts are now on the court and O'Connor's gone, that decision is in effect overruled. And Kennedy writes this opinion with this extraordinarily paternalistic statement that, well, you know, the reason we're banning abortion, these late-term abortions, is that you silly women come to regret it anyway. And this is exactly the kind of thing that drove O'Connor crazy. But it is part of Kennedy's conception of himself as sort of a wise lawgiver that he will pat women on the head and say, look, you know, this is really for your own good. And you'll come to appreciate it in the long term.
How would you describe the balance of power in the Supreme Court now?
John Roberts is in charge. This is his court. Roberts is emerging as one of the most strongly ideological and brilliant justices who's been on the court in many years. You know, his opinions are beautifully written, strongly argued, and very, very conservative. The idea that he was some sort of closet moderate, the idea that he's going to change on the bench, the idea that he is somehow not exactly what he appears to be, is folly. This is a very conservative Chief Justice, and he is using his powers to make the court different from what it was before.
Give us an example of an opinion of his from the past term that you consider ideological.
There was really an extraordinary drama on the last day of the term because the court handed down several opinions, and in each one of them, the court really showed how different it was. On an antitrust case, Roberts led the court in overturning a precedent from 1896 that was arguably in favor of consumers over corporations. He wrote his now most famous opinion as a justice in overturning the efforts of the Louisville and Seattle school districts to use race to preserve some racial balance in schools. And in a death penalty case, he voted in that case with the minority to uphold a death sentence where there was a real strong issue about the mental status of the defendant. In all of those cases, not only did he take the conservative position, but he was walking the court back. He was changing the court's precedents to move the court to the right.
Now, you described Clarence Thomas as the most conservative member of the Rehnquist Court. Is he still the most conservative member of the court?
Clarence Thomas is not just the most conservative member of the Rehnquist Court or the Roberts Court. He's the most conservative justice to serve on the court since the 1930s. If you take what Thomas says seriously, if you read his opinions, particularly about issues like the scope of the federal government, he basically thinks that the entire work of the New Deal is unconstitutional. I mean, he really believes in a conception of the federal government that hasn't been supported by the justices since Franklin Roosevelt made his appointments to the court. You know, I went to a speech Justice Scalia gave at a synagogue here in New York a couple of years ago, and someone asked him, What's the difference between your judicial philosophy and Justice Thomas's? I thought a very good question. And Scalia talked for a while and he said, look, I'm a conservative. I'm a textualist. I'm an originalist, but I'm not a nut.
Meaning that he thinks that Thomas is one?
Well, that was certainly the implication. Uh-huh. And I mean, it was pretty amazing. I mean, Thomas is well outside the mainstream, even of the conservatives on the court.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's a legal correspondent for CNN. He writes about legal issues for The New Yorker, and his new book is called The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. What decisions are you looking to come out of the court in the next term?
I think the biggest is going to be about the Second Amendment. There's a case coming out of Washington, D.C., an ordinance about gun control, and the D.C. Circuit for the first time in a major court ruled that the Second Amendment, which speaks of the right to bear arms, essentially bans gun control. And that case is almost certainly going to the court this year, and I think that's going to be an example of the court using its power to limit liberal governments and to say, we interpret the Second Amendment as banning gun control. And I think that's going to be a huge decision this year. Also, the next Guantanamo cases will probably be up there, an opportunity to expand executive power. It's probably not going to be as dramatic a term as the last one with the abortion case and the school desegregation case, but the agenda items will be ticked off.
Do you expect any other justices to retire during the Bush presidency?
None voluntarily. The three most likely retirees are all on the liberal side of the court. John Paul Stevens is 87 years old. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is in her mid to late 76, I believe. David Souter is 69 years old but doesn't like the job and doesn't like Washington. All three of them are likely to leave soon, but none of them want to turn their seat over to George W. Bush. But the fact that the three of them are likely to leave in the next few years just underlines the stakes of the 2008 presidential election.
And Stevens at the age of 87, I mean, that's a real wild card.
It's a real wild card, but his older brother, Bill Stevens, is still practicing law at the age of 90 in Florida, so who knows? And you know, if you look at Justice Stevens, you talk to Justice Stevens, the guy is in remarkable health. He's at the top of his game. He's an active participant in oral argument. You know, I don't know if he's eating yogurt or what, but the guy, he plays tennis, he plays golf. He's got good genes.
Well, Jeffrey, it's great to talk with you again. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Terry.
Jeffrey Toobin is senior legal analyst for CNN and a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book about the Supreme Court is called The Nine. You can read an excerpt of the book on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our interviews.